Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Eric Golub, a Republican Jewish comedian and political commentator. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. While the nature of life is change, our ability to accurately predict the future seems to be getting shakier every year. As we approach the Jewish New Year of 5772, we look back briefly at the year we've just concluded. And I have to conclude that we had no idea what was coming in the past 12 Hebrew calendar months. As the great prophet Isaiah said, Lo Navi velo ben Navi, I am not a prophet and I am not the son of a prophet. And since Isaiah actually was a prophet and a pretty accurate predictor of the future back in those days, how much more can that be said of we much more humble seekers of a vision of what will come? In other words, we generally have no idea what's coming in the new year, and there's no better proof of that than to look back on the past 12 months. There are now just 4 days left in the Jewish calendar year 5771, and what an odd year it's been. When we celebrated Rosh Hashanah last September, no one predicted that the whole Arab world would be convulsed by popular rebellions, that Hosni Mubarak of Egypt would fall suddenly after more than 30 years in power, in part because of Facebook. And no one predicted that the Tunisian government would collapse in a popular uprising, or that U.S. warplanes would help topple Muammar Gaddafi. Nobody announced a year ago that Syria's dictator Assad would be committing genocide on his own people in an attempt to hold on to his job, or that nearly every Arab dictator, king, and sheikh would be sitting on a shaky throne after decades of successfully commanding kleptocracies. And after all this chaotic embrace of freedom in the Arab world, only the Israelis predicted that eventually it would all turn against them. And only they were right, so far, on this whole subject. And no one predicted that the close allies Israel and Turkey would become completely estranged in less than 12 months. Well, since the Arab winter became the Arab spring, and then the Arab summer, and pretty soon we'll see the Arab fall, and then the Arab winter part two, and then the Arab spring, the sequel, I suppose, the hopes for freedom that surged as longtime dictators of so many of Israel's bad neighbors fell or shook has given way to the reality of often incompetent replacement regimes. And those are mostly headed by military juntas who are looking nervously at the large mobs of Islamists still protesting in the fabled Arab streets. The net effect of all this chaos in Israel's neighborhood is still unclear, as it probably should be. I mean, after delivering High Holy Day sermons every year for the past 18 years or so, I can tell you that every year I end up saying something like, the Hebrew word shana includes the root for change. And boy, did things change in this shana in ways unexpected. Well, I particularly recall the experience of having to completely rewrite Rosh Hashanah sermons just after 9/11 10 years ago, and just after the outbreak of the Second Palestinian Terror Intifada 11 years ago, and just after the economic collapse a few years ago. In those years, nobody could predict what would happen in a few weeks, or days, or sometimes even hours. So, this year, I've chosen to forego predicting the future, leaving that to the many non-experts who get paid to do this inaccurately for a living. Instead, I'll just say that we can learn from all of this inaccurate prophesying that, generally speaking, it's all in God's hands, and the rest of us are just trying to guess. And the High Holy Days provide a wonderful time to focus on that fact. And the reality is that what we really control is, well, none of those meta-trends or huge events. What we really have the ability to shape is our own conduct and character. To remind us of that and to play us in on this morning, just 4 days before Rosh Hashanah, we continue our pre-High Holy Day musical preview with a beautiful rendition of Barosh Hashanah. On Rosh Hashanah it's written, and on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, it is sealed. Who shall live and who shall die? That was cantor David Propus and his daughter Dina singing Barosh Hashanah for the coming of the new year of 5772 this Wednesday and Thursday, and Friday too if you're Orthodox or conservative. You know, if you haven't already done so, it's definitely now time to make arrangements for those High Holy Day services coming up this very week. So, what exactly is a Republican Jewish comedian? Find out from Eric Golub when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina of Mama's Pizza. You know, lots of restaurants offer great food and service, but not all restaurants also offer life lessons. For example, learning to share is a lesson that families try to instill in their kids at an early age. At Mama's, we're here to help. For example, order a slice of pepperoni pizza. One hungry person can definitely eat it, but it's pretty huge, which means you could share it with your kid. What a great example you'd be setting. You're sharing something that you love with someone you love. or get a family-sized calzone. It's really huge. When your family is stuffed, you could share the leftovers with your parents-in-law. It's a generous act that demonstrates your kindness and also might earn you several nights of babysitting. Or order a slice of Mama's delicious cheesecake. The portion is generous, which means, nah, let's not go overboard with the sharing idea. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Tucson Hebrew Academy is an independent school for children from kindergarten through eighth grade. Has a long-standing track record of academic excellence and an unparalleled integrated general and Jewish studies curriculum. With a variety of music and fine arts classes combined with the award-winning sports programs, THA nourishes students in body, mind, and spirit. The atmosphere in the classroom encourages self-assured self-expression, critical thinking, and respect for diverse points of view. THA's low student-teacher ratio gives its highly qualified faculty the ability to provide instruction based on the most up-to-date proven research methods in science, technology, math, and literature. THA students understand the relevance of Jewish values in a modern world. THA sees learning as a way of life and builds a strong sense of community. THA Tucson Hebrew Academy is enrolling now. Give your child the gift of a THA education. For more information on how to enroll or to schedule a tour, call 529-3888. That's 529-3888 or visit thaaz.org. We're delighted to welcome to Two Jewish this morning Eric Golub. He is the most prominent Republican Jewish comedian and blogger. Of course, Republican Jewish comedian sounds slightly like an oxymoron. We'll explore that with Eric in a couple of moments. His blog, Tiger Express, T-Y-G-R-R, has been voted the most passionately followed blog in the country. He grew up in New York, born in Brooklyn, raised in Long Island, living in Los Angeles now, has a bachelor's degree from the University of Judaism and an MBA from USC, was a stockbroker and oil professional, and is now a full-time public speaker and one of the preeminent politically conservative comedians around. Good morning, Eric.
Great to be with you, Rabbi.
So what do your parents think about what you do for a living?
Well, my parents are more concerned with what really matters in life. And since they're not Orthodox, my dad's attitude is, well, I'm glad that you just spoke in front of the governor, but can you shave?
You wrote recently that when New York Jews voted for Anthony Weiner's replacement, New York Jews vote Republican, world officially ending. Coming from New York, most Jews, of course, continue to vote Democratic. And while there are certainly prominent Jewish Republicans and conservatives, how did you end up becoming a conservative?
Well, my parents were conservatives, so to me, conservatism was all I knew. One thing I will say is that, you know, while I used a teaser headline to get people's attention, the truth is that this election should not have been a shock because, as people in the Jewish community know, and many non-Jews don't know this, while Jewish liberals tend to be what I call Seinfeld Jews, meaning they think being Jewish means eating bagels and watching Curb Your Enthusiasm. You know, Orthodox Jews, who I describe to Christians as a cross between the Amish and ZZ Top, Orthodox Jews tend to be rather conservative and not reflexively liberal on social issues. So Orthodox Jews voting for a Republican is not a shocker.
No, really, it isn't. Tell me about you've mentioned that your parents are NRA members, so you would have to marry before having a child. I would assume that her parents would also be Jewish NRA members.
Absolutely, and my dad's a very good shot. I'm also the son of a Holocaust survivor. So when you're the son of a Holocaust survivor, you don't get to make decisions. And I'm also very proud of my faith. I think we have a beautiful multi-thousand-year set of traditions. And while I have a deep respect for my Christian brothers and sisters and those practicing other faiths, they're not my faith. So, you know, I want to marry a Jewish person and have Jewish children.
So are you asking for calls this morning?
I'm not very subtle about it. It clearly says at the bottom of my column that I'm seeking a Republican Jewish brunette. so they can apply anytime they want, and I will review the applications.
I see. And so it has to be brunette?
It's a preference, but that's significantly less important than Republican and Jewish.
If you can find Republican and Jewish, you're doing something interesting, especially non-Orthodox Republican and Jewish. We'll talk more about that with Eric Golub, our guest this morning on Two Jewish, when we return in a few moments.
Choosing the proper care for your mother, father, or other loved one isn't easy. David Shackman and his wife Ann are New Yorkers who recently found a home at Handmaker, Tucson's premier provider of assisted living and senior care.
I'm 88 years old. My wife is 86. And we like staying at Handmaker because people here are very courteous and the atmosphere is nice.
Well, I like the program here because they have entertainers, have a bingo. They made a luau with Hawaiian dances.
Handmaker gives their son, Ken, peace of mind.
I know that they are going to get good service and the staff will treat them as friends.
Handmaker, centrally located on Rosemont just south of Grant, includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, and Tucson's most caring staff. Call 881-2323.
The food here is excellent. It's as good as any good restaurant in New York City.
For a consultation and tour, call 881-2323 or go to handmaker.org.
Taste of Judaism has everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism, but were afraid to ask. In three upbeat, fun, free, informative sessions, Taste of Judaism brings the joy of Jewish life and learning to you. You'll study with outstanding rabbis, including Two Jewish's Rabbi Sam Kohan. Learn what Jewish values, spirituality, and community are all about, and have a great sample of delicious Jewish foods. Classes are offered at various times at three Tucson locations: at Temple Emmanuel in central Tucson, on the northwest side, and on the east side. All classes are open to everyone, Jewish or not. Best of all, Taste of Judaism is free. There's no charge, but you must pre-register by calling 327-4501. More than 3,500 students have taken Taste of Judaism. Why not join them? Call 327-4501 and ask for Mila to register for Taste of Judaism, the most popular and effective introduction to Jewish learning and life. Call 327-4501 for your own Taste of Judaism.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com, T-O-O Jewish Radio, or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can also hear past and present shows through the website or downloading us from there or from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Last night, late, we began the High Holy Day season with Slichot services, the midnight prayers that begin the period of penitence and return, our Yamim Noraim, the Jewish Days of Awe. The music of the High Holy Days is a major part of the experience, and it's both the most challenging and the most beautiful of the whole year. We continue our pre-Rosh Hashanah preview of High Holy Day music now with the beautiful and haunting Ki Kishimcha from the Rosh Hashanah morning service. We offer praise to you, God, who waits for us to return to you.
So
That was Ki Kishimcha from the Rosh Hashanah Morning Service, coming up this Thursday. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy, and the Shana Tova.
Boker Tov, Shana Tova.
Almost.
Nearly.
There has been an awful lot in Israel in this past Jewish calendar year. The big protest movement that sprung up that started over housing and gas prices and too many subsidies for the ultra-Orthodox and not enough good apartments for young people in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem, and mostly Tel Aviv. There's more beneath that, though, isn't there? There's sort of a, I don't know, we would call it an American dream, but there's sort of an Israeli dream of what society is supposed to be.
Yeah, I think that is true. You know, if we go back in history to 1902, when Herzl, the person that visioned Israel, have wrote his novel, Alt Neuland, the new old land.
Right, the novel Alt Neuland, right.
He had a phrasing, in Hebrew you would call it hadadiyut. The English translation would be mutuality. He suggested the society we would like to see in Israel should be an alternative to what we currently have. Currently, you know, in the world at those days and also today, we have socialists, and we have capitalism, right? He suggested a third alternative, an alternative he called mutuality, hadadiyut. That actually said, you know, we want to have a free market. We want to have a competition. But we do acknowledge that the control over the manufacturer equipment, over the factories, should be in the hands of the people. We want the people to be the owners of the assets. Now, if you think about it, historically, communism started from the same approach, saying people should be the owners of the assets. But then communism kind of lost the way when they said, okay, we'll give the government this, you know, miraculous genius dwarf somewhere to define what is right and what to do with the asset. And that didn't really work, okay, because that created corruption. On the other hand, in capitalism, you know, we see a lot of also poverty and stuff because of all the question of who owns.
Large bifurcation between the rich and the poor. The kinds of spreads we talked about are happening in Israel with certain large families, very, very wealthy, super rich, and then more poor people farther down.
Exactly. So Herzl's approach was to come and say, you know what, let's give the people in small groups, in different groups, in different ways, let's give them to be the owners of the assets. Let's spread the wealth in a way that won't give anyone the control, not the government, not a certain family, but give the people the real ownership of the factory they work in. Okay? So that was his idea. You know, if you have a factory with 100 employees, each one of them will get a share. You know, it could be through the stock market. You know, and if you want to fire an employee, the factory would buy back the share. Okay, which will allow that person to have some money so he can go around and search for new work or stuff like that. So that was a very interesting approach. By the way, from a feministic point of view, in 1902, Herzl said that women would have equal rights to vote and everything. Today it sounds, oh, of course, but in 1902...
Yeah, I mean, women didn't get the votes in the United States until, 1919 or so. I mean, it was a revolutionary idea still.
Right. So you know, I think it also shows us a little bit about him as a person. He was very liberal and an amazing visionary. And he thought, and I think many people still believe that Israel should set the example of how a just society should be.
So I think that, you know, we can extrapolate that to the young people who don't think it's going the right direction. They still have this vision. And in a way, that's very hopeful to see people willing to protest peacefully for what they believe in. Thanks, Guy. A Shana Tova Matuka to you and your whole family.
Shana Tova.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with famed restaurateur Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant, the J Bar, and Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, that is really just a wonderful restaurant you've built downtown. Tell us about it.
Well, we're really excited about it. We haven't even been open a year yet, and we've been named the best new restaurant in Tucson. The food is fantastic. It's a lot different than what we do at Llanos and J-Bar. It's really American food, but it's American food through the eyes of the latest round of immigrants to the country. So it's American food that's Asian and it's Latin American and it's African and it's from the Middle East. It's a wonderful, wonderful flavors opened up to us. And that bar is pretty great too.
Fantastic. And all kinds of specialty drinks too.
That's one of the things that we're really having a lot of fun with. You know, come in and we've got 20 or 30 specialty cocktails you've never had before. Everyone you're going to want to have again.
What's the phone number to call for reservations, or where's the website?
623-7700, downtownkitchen.com.
Thanks, Llanos. Can't wait to eat there with you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom. L'shana tova, almost.
Good morning, Rabbi, and Happy New Year to you as well.
The big story of the past year internationally has been all the focus on the Arab winter, spring, all the change in the Arab world. But Arabs are certainly not the only Muslims in the world. They're probably not the majority of the Muslims in the world, right?
Yeah, I find that, you know, many Americans, including highly educated ones, tend to think of Muslims and Arabs as somehow being synonymous. And although we may have talked about this before, it was so many years ago that I think it might be helpful to review who's on first here. Arabs are a linguistic group. They're people whose mother tongue or whose mother's mother's tongue was Arabic. And there are Christian Arabs, there are Jewish Arabs, there are Muslim Arabs, there are atheist Arabs. Being an Arab has nothing to do with religion. That being said, Arabs are really a tiny percentage of the Muslim world. And it's important to remember that countries like Turkey and Iran, which are both close neighbors of Israel and big players in Middle East politics, are not Arab countries. And both Turks and Iranians get quite upset if you confuse them with Arabs. Probably half or slightly more than half of Muslims in the world live in the country that used to be called British India, which is today India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, right. Three countries. And there you have about 50-55% of the Muslim world. But then you have another at least 30-35% to the east of that in countries like Malaysia, Indonesia, southern Thailand, the Philippines, et cetera, et cetera. So if you add those numbers, you get quickly to 80-90% of the Muslim world living east of the area that American politics is so obsessed with, the oil-producing Middle East.
And that's not to mention the Muslims who live in sub-Saharan Africa, for example.
Right, Muslims in Africa, well. Muslims in Europe, Muslims all over the world. Right. But, you know, we're talking about big percentages of Muslims in the population or countries which are almost entirely Muslim. That's what I'm focused on right now in that little sketch of where it is that Muslims live. So we end up obsessing about a part of the world that contains at most 15 to 20% of the world's Muslims, and yet we still manage to confuse all of those Muslims with Arabs. And, you know, there's minorities even in Arab countries of Copts and Syriacs and other types of Christians. Even some tiny Jewish communities are left. There are Aramaic speakers left. There's no such thing, really, as a completely homogeneous country which is Arab and Muslim, et cetera, et cetera. The closest thing there probably is to that is Saudi Arabia, which is in itself a mixed bag and which hasn't shown many signs yet of participating in this wider phenomenon loosely known as the Arab Spring. But what I'd like to discuss next week is the impact that the so-called Arab Spring has on the rest of the world, on people living in the Arab world, on the state of Israel, and on near neighbors, which are not Arab countries, but are Muslim countries like Turkey and Iran. So with your permission, we'll defer that subject till next week.
And next year, for that matter.
Okay, look forward to it.
L'shana tova. It's time for our old Jewish joke of the week, the last one of the year. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as an exclusive public service. Rivka has a heart attack. She's taken to the hospital. While she's on the operating table, she has a near-death experience. Seeing God, she asks, "Is my time up?" And God says, "No. You have another 36 years to go." Relieved and upon recovery, in a choice to embrace her life, Rivka decides to stay in the hospital and have a facelift, a nose job, liposuction, and a tummy tuck. She changes her hair color, redoes the style, everything. She's a completely new woman. While in the hospital recovering, she does some thinking. Since she has so much more time to live, she figures she might as well make the most of it. She decides to move to Malibu, buy a convertible, really live it up. But that day, as she's crossing the street after leaving the hospital, she's killed by an ambulance. Arriving in heaven in front of God, Rivka demands, "I thought you said I had another 36 years. Why didn't you take me out of the path of the ambulance?" And God says, "Oi, Rivka, I didn't recognize you." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. While this week we'll celebrate the new Jewish year with joy, we also engage over the 10 days of repentance in a cheshbon hanefesh, an accounting of the soul, which requires that we read some challenging texts from the Torah. The reading for Rosh Hashanah is the Binding of Isaac, the Akedat Yitzchak. Reformed Jews will read it Thursday on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, Orthodox and Conservative Jews on the second morning of Rosh Hashanah, Friday. In a version of this complex tale from chapter 22 of Genesis, Abraham is told to sacrifice his beloved son Isaac up on Mount Moriah. Bob Dylan retold the tale in his song Highway 61. There he has Abraham object to killing his son and then apparently acquiescing.
God said to Abraham, "Kill me a son." Abe said, "Man, you must be putting me on." God said, "No." Abe said, "What?" God said, "You can do what you want, Abe, but next time you see me coming, you better run." Well, Abe said, "Where do you want this killing done?" God said, "Hold on Highway 61.
Now, in spite of his apparent biblical scholarship, Bob Dylan isn't exactly perfectly accurate to the text of Genesis. For one thing, in the Torah, Abraham doesn't object in the least to sacrificing Isaac. For another, at the climax of the Akedah story, just as Abraham lifts the knife to slaughter Isaac, God sends an angel to prevent the killing. Weird and powerful as the text is, and influential too, as poet Chaim Guri says, we are all born with that knife in our hearts. The essential message of the Akedah reading is that we are not supposed to sacrifice our children, and that we are, in fact, commanded to teach them to choose life and mitzvot, rather than evil or sin. Along with that Torah reading about Abraham offering up Isaac, there's a remarkable convergence of Torah portions this week. Rosh Hashanah's story of the near death of Isaac, whose sacrifice was averted to prove that child sacrifice was no longer acceptable, is paralleled by the Shabbat Torah portion this week, Ha'azinu, which tells of the death of Moses, a passage filled with poetry and pathos. These readings fall during a period when the Unetane Tokef prayer reminds us that on Rosh Hashanah it's written, and on Yom Kippur it is sealed, who shall live and who shall die. It's a time of year when we are directly confronted with the truth of our own mortality and strongly encouraged to seek to live better lives in the year to come. This time of year of the High Holy Days, the Days of Awe, always makes explicit the fact that it's a challenge as American Jews to find ways to make our lives better and holier while living in a society that often values possessions over ethics. During these 10 days of repentance, may we all come to care more for our family and friends, and less for our material goods and desires. May you and your family be blessed with a Shana Tova Umetuka, a good and a sweet new year of 5772. When we come back on Two Jewish, comedian Eric Golub, one of the very, very few Republican Jewish comedians, tries to rearrange our thinking in time for the new year. Find out how successfully when we return shortly on Two Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Last week, Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, appeared before the United Nations and made the semi-meaningless gesture of seeking a Palestinian state. While nearly everyone, including right-wing Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu, has accepted the eventual necessity of a Palestinian state, Israelis, Americans, and most responsible Europeans, Germany, France, England, and so on, believe that it has to come through peaceful negotiations with Israel, rather than through international pressure and hyperbole. The U.S. can veto any U.N. Security Council resolution on the subject, but a U.N. General Assembly vote can make Palestine a kind of observer state, which gives it some rights that can help it make more trouble for Israel internationally. You know, this declaration of a state is not the end of the world, but it surely is a problem, and the tension in Israel and throughout the Jewish world on this issue is notably high. As the Palestinians deliver this Rosh Hashanah gift to Israel by declaring statehood, the full implications of the move of the UN are not entirely clear, except that they highlight the increasing Israeli diplomatic isolation in the world. What is evident is that Israel's relations with other Muslim countries, formerly allies or at least quiet non-belligerents, are in steady decline. Turkey, once a close Israeli ally economically and militarily, and as recently as this spring considering regional cooperation on energy and water, has gone from offering oil and gas to Israel to threatening to send gunboats to try to break the blockade of the Gaza Strip, and they have now expelled the Israeli ambassador. And last week, King Abdullah of Jordan, a quiet partner with Israel in many agreements. In fact, Egypt and Jordan are the only Arab countries to actually sign peace accords with Israel since the founding of the state in 1948. King Abdullah declared that Israel's leaders are sticking their heads in the sand on the Palestinian issue. Remember, the population of Jordan is about 75% Palestinian and only about 25% Hashemite Jordanians, the ethnic background of the ruling elite and, of course, King Abdullah himself. Public criticism from Arab leaders is, of course, nothing new for Israel, but Jordan is generally kept out of the spotlight on these issues since it has regular cooperation with Israel in water resources use, trade, agriculture, and other fields. Like every Arab country, Jordan has seen widespread protests in the past year, but as usual, the canny Jordanian monarchy has responded with a variety of smallish concessions that have kept the pot there boiling at a less than revolutionary temperature. Still, open criticism of Israel by Jordan is not a positive sign. And the more serious breakdown in relations between Israel and Egypt has now taken an odd and symbolic turn. The Israeli Agriculture Ministry says that Egypt has banned the export of palm fronds to Israel for the holiday of Sukkot. Egypt supplies about 700,000 of the fronds for the Feast of Tabernacles, Sukkot, which begins in about a month. The fronds are used for the lulavs, shaken on the festival, a central observance of the holiday. More expensive Israeli palm fronds will have to be substituted for the Egyptian ones, increasing the cost of lulav and etrog sets by about 10% this year. You know, frankly, as a user of lulavs and etrogs, I never knew my lulav set had Egyptian palm fronds in it until now, and I would probably have been happy to pay the extra $3 for one made entirely in Israel. Although, I secretly suspect they will substitute a supplier in Mexico or somewhere else. We do live in a truly global economy. Anyway, there's no word from Egypt on the reason for the lulav ban, but it follows the recent storming of the Israeli embassy, which followed the terrorist attack near Eilat that came through Egypt's Sinai Desert, which of course followed the fall of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak last winter. If economic relations between Israel and Egypt continue to deteriorate, estimates say it would cost Egypt about $1 billion annually and the loss of 70,000 jobs. Israel would be affected at a much lower rate. On a lighter note, last Shabbat at dawn, over the lowest spot on Earth, the Dead Sea was very much alive, with more than 1,000 floating nude Israelis posed for a mass shoot by U.S. photographer Spencer Tunick. The project, Tunick's first nude shoot in the Middle East, is part of a bid to boost Israel's campaign to have the salt-saturated feature recognized as one of the world's 7 natural wonders in a global online vote coming up in November. For Spencer Tunick, a Jewish American who has arranged naked human bodies over prominent landscapes and landmarks ranging from a Swiss glacier, yeesh, to the Sydney Opera House, a nude installation is an indicator of a host country's openness. Indeed. In some places, the work is a little bit more controversial. In other places, the works are accepted. It's a litmus test for how free a country is, how open a country is, and how full of rights a country is, said Tunick. Orthodox Jewish politicians and rabbis protested over what they termed the Sodom and Gomorrah nature of Tunick's work. You know, kind of appropriate since it was at the Dead Sea. And they threatened to take legal action against the plan to strip in public. The head of the local council, in whose area the early morning photo shoot took place, threatened to call police to disperse it. He said it was offensive to local residents. But organizers kept the location secret until the last moment. There were no hitches to the 2-hour session at the Mineral Beach complex, not very far from where the biblical cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, irreparably overrun by sin, were destroyed by God along with their inhabitants. Spencer Tunick grew up in the largely Hasidic community of South Fallsburg, New York. He said that he could understand how religious people would find his work offensive, and that's why he decided to do the work on Shabbat, so no one would be walking by and see a naked person half a mile away and be offended, he said. Experts warn the Dead Sea could dry out by 2050 unless urgent steps are taken to halt its demise. The Dead Sea's surface level is plunging about 1 meter a year. The shoreline has receded by more than half a mile in many places. For Ari Frucht, who initiated the project and has toiled over its preparations for the past 4 years, a work by Spencer Tunick could raise awareness of the sea's condition and galvanize Israel's government into action. He believes there's another aspect as well. The world needs to know that Israelis are not religious extremists, he said, ahead of the event. No word on whether he was clothed when he said that. A jubilant Spencer Tunick praised the brave participants of this installation, some of whom flew to Israel, especially to get naked in the Dead Sea. This could happen nowhere else in the Middle East, he said, in one of the great understatements of all time. Men and women headed to the showers and buses after it finished. If you love freedom in New York, freedom in London, freedom in Italy, there's freedom in Israel, and I think this is very important for people to understand. Indeed, clothed or otherwise. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back on To Jewish our guest this morning, Eric Golub, the most prominent Republican Jewish comedian, certainly of his generation. I don't know, do you count Jackie Mason as a Republican Jewish comedian these days?
Absolutely. I had the pleasure of meeting him a couple of years ago, and he is a fine, fine man. I think the world of him. People don't really associate him as a Republican Jewish comedian only because he was a comedian his whole life, and then one day in his later years became political. I was always a political animal, and then one day went on the speaking circuit and chose a comedic approach. So you're not really going to find me in a comedy club, per se. You'll find me, say, at a Lincoln or a Reagan dinner, leading a Tea Party rally. The emphasis is on the Republican, with comedy being the means to an end.
You said, quoting Larry Greenfield, that a lot of Jews vote Democrat because they still think it's FDR's 20th term. Tell me why you think Jews should vote Republican.
Well, because the civilization of the entire world is at stake. We're in a struggle between civilization and barbarism. And the thing about liberal Jews is they care about social issues. If Osama bin Laden were to walk into a Reform Jewish synagogue, they would ask his stance on Roe versus Wade before determining if he was good or bad. All liberal Jewish women care about is abortion. Everything in life comes down to that. Now, the terrorists that flew the planes into the towers, they did not care if you were gay or straight. They did not care about your stance on cap and trade and fossil fuels. They did not care pro-life versus pro-choice. They were pro-death. Now, it's very easy to care about social issues and sing kumbaya during peacetime. But when third world genocidal lunatics, radical Islamists, are trying to kill us all, you have to go with people that are going to stop that. And the Democratic Party of JFK does not exist anymore. And until the Democratic Party tells us what they are going to do to keep us safe, it is infantile to vote Democrat.
So I have to say, if Osama bin Laden walked in anywhere right now, the Messiah would have preceded him.
Well, true. He is dead and thankfully burning underground with 72 Helen Thomases. But in general, liberal Jews are not concerned about the war on terror, and Israel is not their top priority. They're liberal first and Jewish second. They care about abortion, gay rights, and global warming. So, unfortunately, to try to explain to them Israel, it's just not a draw in the same way there are plenty Irish and Italians in this country that don't care about Ireland and Italy, and plenty of cafeteria Catholics that don't take orders from the Vatican. So we need to explain to these liberal Jews that the terrorists don't distinguish liberals from conservatives. They're still trying to kill us all, and Fort Hood was one that succeeded. The Christmas Day bomber and the underwear bomber almost succeeded, and we're not going to have civilization if they get it right. And they only need to get it right once. And right now, the Republican Party is the only political party in America that is specifically prepared to deal with the threat of Islamofascism, which is the defining threat of our lifetimes.
I have a different sort of question for Eric. As a Jew in really conservative circles, do you always feel accepted? Have you ever felt any restriction or any bigotry?
Absolutely. Liberal Jews are bullies. And it is ironic that, you know, my dad is a Holocaust survivor. I mentioned that before. You know, he escaped intolerance to face it in our own community. I mean, liberal Jews have been so oppressed through their entire history that they now take the one people that they can bully, and they do it, and that being Republican Jews. And liberal Jews are absolutely hostile toward Republican Jews, and it is disgraceful. I remember being in a synagogue, and I'm not going to mention the name of it, but I was in Valley Beth Shalom in Encino when the rabbi around Hanukkah time. And
I'm glad you're not mentioning the synagogue.
Yeah, but anyway, around Hanukkah, you know, which, as you know, is a neocon holiday. Judah Maccabee gave the blueprint for Paul Wolfowitz, or actually I should say Maccabee means hammer, so maybe they were talking about Sir Charles of Krauthammer. But the Maccabees understood what you do in a war. You burn every village, slaughter every goat, kill every bad guy, and then plant a flag in the ground, name a holiday after it, and chest thump Well, unfortunately, this rabbi at Valley Beth Shalom in Encino on Hanukkah said, picture a world without Donald Rumsfeld. Now, I did a slow burn, looked to him, and said, picture a world where you lose your tax-exempt status. So they're just bullies.
So as a Jew circulating in circles with also lots of evangelical Christians who support Israel strongly, but, of course, you know, basically still want all Jews to convert to Christianity somewhere down the road.
That's not true. Well, I have to take issue with that. The number of conservative Christians, and I speak in front of thousands of them, that have tried to convert me is zero, okay? The only people that have ever tried to convert me are liberal Jews to liberalism and Ron Paul supporters to the planet Rapulon.
How is the weather there?
You know, I try to avoid those people. I call it Rapulon because if you even type in the words Ron Paul, they will just flood your columns and type nonsense. So the only way to escape them is to not even spell out the words. It's a form of self-censorship. But getting back to your question about Christians, Christians simply believe in love thy neighbor. And while I'm sure that, you know, 1/100 of 1% of them may believe in the rapture and converting us all, most of them simply understand that the Jews are the good guys and the Palestinians are the bad guys, and that there's no moral equivalence between Jews trying to defend themselves and Palestinians trying to blow up innocent victims. And if Jews can understand that, then there's no reason why Christians can't understand that. They're simply applying the same logical reasoning that we are. So they just simply get it. And even if you have no emotional connection to Israel, because many Christians are non-religious the same way many Jews are non-religious, they just simply understand right versus wrong and democracy versus evil dictatorships.
All right, I'd like you to handicap the current Republican presidential crop.
Well, one of the things I say is that the Republican Party is not a democracy. It's a dictatorship. It's a hierarchy. Republicans always pick the person who's next in line. Six PBWGs, that stands for powerful, bald, white guys. Six PBWGs get in a room and say, okay, whose turn is it? It's Mitt Romney's turn. Now, that is not an endorsement or a condemnation. I'm actually passionate about Rudy Giuliani. But I believe that unless that cycle is broken, Mitt Romney will be the nominee. People look at him and go, look, he's tall, he has good hair, and he's inoffensive, which means Tim Pawlenty will probably be the vice president because he's tall, good hair, inoffensive, and so harmlessly nondescript that he might be standing in your living room right now.
Eric, you have a MBA from USC, which for those of us who went to UCLA, you know, is a little bit questionable, but I understand. Are you going to do this?
I don't care about the rivalry. That's grad school. I mean, UCLA people have never done anything to me. I live in Westwood.
There you go. Do you see doing this for the rest of your career?
I have the best job in the world. I mean, the fact is that I get paid to spout my opinions and to steal a line from a mutual fund manager. I may be often wrong, but never in doubt. But I'm not any less qualified to offer my opinions than anybody else, and I'm certainly not less qualified than Barack Obama because I've actually been gainfully employed in my lifetime. So, yes, I could see myself doing this forever, and the only thing left to do is find a Republican Jewish brunette partner in crime and travel the country with her, spreading the good word until Jews are voting Republican nationwide and the Republican Party and a dominant conservative majority takes over.
You can find Eric Golub's views on Tiger Express. That's what, TYGRRExpress.com, is that correct?
Well, it's four R's, TYGRRExpress.com, and my three books are Ideological Bigotry, Ideological Violence, and Ideological Idiocy.
Always subtle and softly expressed. I want to thank Eric Golub for a great visit here on Too Jewish and say L'Shana Tova, a good year and a healthy year.
God bless.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community.
Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 when our guest will be author Amy Efron. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or on TooJewishRadio.com and friend us on Facebook. Our playout this morning comes in honor of the Jewish High Holy Days, which start this Wednesday night and Thursday with Rosh Hashanah, beginning September 28th, don't forget. It's cantor David Fisher's classic Shana Tova, A Good New Year. My friends, in this coming year of 5772, may you and your family have a Shana Tova Metuka, a good and a sweet year of health, happiness, and success. And as always, may you enjoy a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Slicha gam ahava tavi pius vegam shalva yamim holchim yamim bayim silchi gam at lachah.